and my hand just started like violently shaking, and I had the same symptoms of a patient that was now dead. My response was basically like, fuck you. The value of love and appreciation as a currency and how it's often worth so much more than money. Like, as soon as something becomes transactional, the magic kind of goes.
So then how do you think about incorporating love into other areas of the business?
With consumers, it's with the team, it's...
And the love compounds.
Yes, it's like the love flywheel. We flywheel our love in Manulife.
There are lots of these things that you do which don't scale. Assuming Manulife is going to keep on its growth trajectory.
How do you keep that? Those little personal moments, they're not about delivering numbers. It's about fueling the beast.
I'm going to kick us off in quite a rogue way, right? And because you've been here for a couple of hours, I'm actually going to drop you right in the deep end.
Okay.
If that's all right.
Yeah, cool. Let's do it.
Bit nervous. You mentioned previously that you were very ill when you were a teenager. And doctors told you at one point that you weren't ever going to be able to write or work again.
Yeah, which is weird because I was only 15, so I hadn't really done much work up until then. So I think it was just work, full stop. But yeah.
Wow. What was your reaction hearing that? And why was it that they said that?
So for context, when I was 15, I got diagnosed with something called Wilson's disease, which is like, it's like a metabolic disorder that basically meant or means that my body can't metabolize copper, which is in loads of food. And it came out, I remember it really well. It came out, I was in a history class and I was writing an essay and my hand just started like violently shaking. So it was like neurological symptoms. My parents were actually away that weekend. So I was at home with my brother and they called in a friend of ours who's a GP and she came and looked at me. And I had the same symptoms of a patient that she'd seen like 2 weeks before. I found this all out later, that she'd seen before that was now dead. So it was like pretty serious. So Wilson's was like a hepatic neurological disorder, which is like fully managed and treatable now. So it's no issue. My response? It's quite funny. I haven't really thought about it. My response was basically like, fuck you. Which on reflection is like, was a key driver for quite a long time. I used to call it the like, fuck you driver, which is, 'cause that's what it was. And I was just like, you've got no right to tell me that. And obviously ended up doing all right and obviously working like very, very hard. But I do think that period in life was like super formative for a whole heap of reasons. It was really tough, like, really tough for 2 years. It was pretty serious, but it's definitely like laid a foundation of probably one of, if not the toughest things that ever happened, which makes everything, it gives context to like suffering thereafter, right? Like I think everyone suffers and people suffer way more than I did, and I was very lucky to have a family that supported me through it. It's just, I think I was quite fortunate to have it happen early. Because then thereafter, like, growth happens.
What shaped your character such that in that situation you said, fuck you?
Probably just deeply entrenched middle-class arrogance. I don't know. Yeah, I've never really thought about it. I think because my foundations as a wee boy were like pretty strong, from like a super good family, loved... pretty unconditionally, largely. Obviously, there's always a bit of conditional love, but largely unconditional, which I think is really important. So I was pretty solid when I got the news, like very solid. I became very unsolid for a period thereafter. But I think if I'd been in a position of like not feeling very good about myself or like whatever you want to call it, weak, and I'd heard that, it could have gone the other way. Because I think a lot of people who had what I had really like struggle for life. So yeah, very, very fortunate. I was aware, and I've always been aware of how lucky I am and was to have like a really solid family and friends around me.
What an incredible reflection.
Yeah. I guess so.
What was the period post that diagnosis?
Oh God, like? Man, it's so funny. So obviously it wasn't funny at the time, but...
if I'd have told 15-year-old you, sorry, mate, you're going to be laughing about this.
Yeah. So there's hepatic stuff, which basically means like liver stuff, which wasn't really that noticeable because you're not that conscious of what's going on in your liver. But the neurological stuff was super prevalent. And I basically, over the period of 2 years, had like savagely deep depressions and psychosis and like some quite dark stuff. And then would come out of them into these like just amazing highs. Like, and obviously for everyone else, they were horrific because I was just off the wall. But I had no idea I was off the wall. And those periods always corresponded to when I was doing exams. So what would happen is the start of the school year, I'd just be completely buggered, like super depressed. I think, yeah, like fair to say, like suicidal, like bad. But again, had the support, and it would be like, what's going to happen this year? We're going to have to redo the year. And then it would get around to kind of like February, March time, and I'd hit a high and just like blitz my exams, because when you're high, your mental capacity is like pretty, you're kind of firing all cylinders. And I was quite funny. So one of the things that I got from all of this, because obviously couldn't write, would get knackered, like brain was a bit frazzled. I had like the best special needs exam set up in like my school's history. So I had like unlimited time, no, 25% extra time, but I could stop the clock for as long as I wanted to have a nap. So I remember in my GCSE English exam, I read the question, was a bit tired, so I kind of had a nap. I'm not sure this is appropriate to say, but whatever. I had a nap, and I finished my GCSE English exam like 20 minutes, and it was like a 2-hour exam, and just like did really well. But yeah, it was depression, psychosis, and then like mania that subsequently stabilized.
That is a lot for a teenager to...
Yeah, it was quite a lot.
...deal with, especially when you're doing GCSEs, which everyone tells you are like the biggest exams of your life, right?
Yeah, and then it carried on to like... We did IB as well, so it carried on through to that as well. But it's good because it like adds a handicap to make it a bit more of a proud moment when you manage through.
What did the support from your family look like? You said they were super supportive.
I guess like love, I suppose. There were like some specific examples. Dropped off and picked up from school rather than getting the bus. So when I was in a hypermanic period, you'd always get quite badly behaved, and everything heightened. So like more angry, more boisterous, whatever. And I got suspended from school the first term of my, year before I left school, so what, lower sixth. So an example there is that was a decision that a new headmaster for the school made, and he initially said that he wanted to expel me, and my school tutor, who actually came to my wedding, I only found out this out years later, basically said to him, it's quite emotional, said to him, if you expel Stu, I'll quit, which is like, what? Because we were really close. I think, yeah, she like changed my life. And then in that term, when I was suspended, my cousin who lives in Canada flew over to the UK and basically looked after me. He's pretty wild as well, so we had a good time. but he looked after me for 3 months. So again, like that relationship is super special. And then, yeah, I guess people being very supportive when I was completely buggered down and out, and then somehow managing to maintain a degree of understanding when I was just going completely mad.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how did this teacher change your life?
Well, she stopped me getting expelled, for one. She was the scribe in my math exams because I couldn't write. She wouldn't do the sums, but she'd write out the sums or whatever it was. Just like when I was super down at school, I'd go speak to her. When I was super up, going crazy, annoying people, she would, a lot of the stuff was like behind the scenes. She would like explain to them what's going on. Yeah, she's amazing. So yeah, I got married in lockdown. And her and her husband, who's also a teacher, who's a great guy, were one of the 30 people that came to the wedding.
Wow.
Which I think is probably quite special for her. Would hope so, but she's a very special lady.
And also just hearing that she's changed your life is probably every teacher's dream, right?
Yeah, it's funny. I've got a friend, I was out for dinner with her last night, who's also a great teacher. And she's saying how she occasionally sees her old pupils and, yeah, how they say, how they pull her up and say, like, miss, you changed my life, I want to be a teacher just like you. It must just be amazing.
Wow.
Conversely, if you're a terrible teacher, it's pretty awful because everyone hates you. But
yeah.
There's not so many of those.
Well, thank you so much for sharing. That's very open of you. And now that we've gone to, like, probably one of the most intimate parts of your life, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, cool.
For anyone who's not sure about who the legend that Stu McDonald is.
Yeah. So Stu, dad, husband, brother, son. And I guess the reason probably here is because I founded a peanut butter brand that has become an almond butter and peanut brand called Manny Life, which is, I think, like, irrevocably the best tasting peanut butter in definitely United Kingdom. And we basically adopt the same principles you're used to seeing in things like coffee and chocolate, like traditionally craft categories to peanut butter. So things like sourcing the best peanuts in the world from a single estate, adding value through like craft processes as opposed to added ingredients to create like mind-bendingly delicious products. And yeah, work with some pretty cool people along the way as well, which is what kept it going and keeps it going still.
And the thing that drew me to you is that you have this really strong connection with people.
Yeah.
Your motto used to be the peanut butter people.
Yeah.
And now it's peanut
butter.
So
no, we let that go, but yeah.
And like Manny is Latam for peanuts, and then life is about bringing people together, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Why is there such this strong affinity to people?
I think it's probably always been there. I think, so if I go into like how Manny Life started, I basically was offered a job as an accountant, didn't want to do it, so put it off and moved to Argentina, where the idea was I was going to go there and build up enough guilt to become an accountant for 3 years. And that was where I kind of fell into peanut butter. So we worked for a peanut butter social enterprise. We'd go around teaching kids and families how to use the stuff. So the reaction we got from them, both from like just a happiness level, but like the impact we had on their diets was amazing. So got kind of into it. But the big change or the big step change moment was when I tracked down the family that that we still source from today, who grow the peanuts that, we still use. And I just absolutely love them. And I always say that if they'd made honey or something else, I'd have started a brand that did a honey brand or something else. So it's very fortunate they grew peanuts because peanut butter obviously was having its moment. And then I think the fact that it started in Argentina, and the Argentines are like a very, very welcoming, very like community-led culture. Like the two most consumed things there are mate and barbecue, and you literally like you can't have those things alone, or you don't have those things alone. So that was probably quite formative. I found myself in Argentina. But it's always been there. Like my parents are super sociable. I've always kind of been a very arms wide open thing. So yeah, I think that's maybe where it comes from.
The family that you went and met, is the guy called Edu?
Yeah, so Edu's not actually part of the family, but he's the guy who I was and probably still am most close to. Our families have hung out loads.
What is it about Edu that really drew you to him?
He's just a fucking great guy. And again, it's funny, like he's an amazing guy, but it's also like his character and like degree of support and friendliness and care isn't uncommon at all in Argentina. Like some of my best friends are people who still live out in Argentina who I knew for 6 months, 7 months, and then we're still in touch today. There's something, I mean, if you haven't been, there's something about the Argentine, and it's probably a bit Italian as well, culture, where it's just very welcoming and there's a lot of genuine care. One of the things I often speak about or used to speak about is that when I was there for a year, and did someone ask me what I did? Like, it's like, that's not a question. It's like a who you are, it's kind of a strange thing, but there's this like desire and interest in the person and what you do for a living is irrelevant. Whereas here is like the second question you get asked always. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it does, it signals like a difference in, I don't know, like values.
What is their small talk question?
I don't think they really have one. They're very good at unpacking stuff and going quite deep quite quickly. But also most of my friends are pretty funny as well. And I found this out later, but it makes a lot of sense. Argentines get more therapy than any other culture in the world. There's more therapists per capita in Argentina than there is anywhere in the world. So that might have something to do with it. They're just very good at like real talk.
So then translating that into business, you've had this same supplier since you went out there and you developed this really strong relationship with his family.
Yeah. Yeah.
How have you maintained that relationship with one of the most pivotal parts of the business?
So I didn't actually go back to Argentina for about 6 years because we couldn't afford to go back. I now go back every year. But yeah, it's just like how you'd maintain a relationship with a friend. It's just like chat, family, updates, personal updates. Obviously, keeping them up to date with the business is part of it, but it's so much more than that. And I genuinely think they really value the relationship. Like we're kind of small fry compared to a lot, and particularly in the early days compared to a lot of their customers. But we've always punched above our weight. Like when the harvest last year was horrendous, they were rationing their other customers. We didn't get rationed. We got a full load. Yeah, it's just like how you keep up with your brother, which is nice. And it's genuine as well. It's not strategic. Like, how do we stay close to the family? It's just like, I just really like them. Which is useful, because if I didn't like them, it wouldn't be as fun.
And this notion of fun seems like to be the thread throughout Manny Life's story. Yeah. When you were getting started, like you had a shipment come in of a ton of peanuts and then your manufacturer pulled out and you had to get 45 mates to jar 4,000 pots.
Yeah.
And then again, when Ocado asked you for 9,000 mini pots, you like again rally the troops to get people to do that within like 2 days without ever being paid, right?
And so the first guys didn't get paid. Lots of the Gusto lot were just friends, they didn't take money, but there are a few that did get paid because the business was turning over like 200 grand a year at that point, so we paid the people that wanted to be paid, but lots didn't, which was lovely of them.
But the main thread with what kept the volunteers there coming back was this element of fun.
Right? Yeah.
It's that you paid them with this like love and care, which is sort of matches with the Argentines and then instilled this fun into the whole process.
And it was interesting because it was very much always about keeping them entertained, because was very aware they weren't getting paid and it had to be fun. That wasn't always necessarily that fun for me, which is fine. Because I was like stressing about like, what's the output? How much is this? How much do we have enough? Are we going fast enough? Whilst at the same time being like, guys, don't worry, just play some music, whatever. But yeah, it's really interesting because I talked to the team about this now as well. And like the value of love and appreciation as a currency and how it's often, nearly always actually, worth so much more than money. Like as soon as something becomes transactional, the magic kind of goes. And I remember, so when we used to do events, it was all volunteers, consumers. We put a note out on Facebook, whatever, and we'd get loads of people in. It was amazing. So much fun. There was this like serious buzz and loved it. And they all loved it. And then I remember getting to a stage where it was like, we weren't making money, but we were making sales. And I was like, I got to start paying these guys. This is ridiculous. And there was a brief moment, maybe like 3 or 4 months, where the magic just went and it became quite weird. It was almost like awkward. It was like the people that were doing it for free before we're now getting paid and there was almost like an elephant in the room, and then you get over it and it's fine. But there is something magic about like love as a currency, so long as it's not exploitative, which obviously it never got to that stage, but that's the kind of flip side.
And so then how do you think about incorporating love into other areas of the business now when it's not just like a, hey, please can you like help save this company that I'm trying to start?
How do I incorporate love? I think it's with consumers, it's picking moments to keep things really personal. So when we get messages of people having bad days or fans' birthdays, we'll spend hours pulling together like bespoke gifts for them and send them out. When we get complaints, like pretty safe. So I've called up pretty much everyone who's complained to Manulife, or at least I've got a list of people to call, and there's not that many. With the team, it's just, yeah, just taking time to have lunch and chat. We're actually not as good as we could be with the team. And it's also, it's much harder now that we're hybrid. So we're in the office 2 days a week. Whereas before it was natural, it's like Thursday beers, work stops, you chat, you get to know each other better. Whereas now we've got to be much more deliberate. So we do like monthly socials and all that, and take birthdays and weddings and stuff seriously. But it's just like remembering to keep it personal, I think, is the key kind of rule. That's a very long, rambling answer.
No, that's a great answer.
Yeah.
Where would you do more with the team if you snapped your fingers and it happened tomorrow?
So, like, this is impossible because of how we've set up and where we all live now. But if I could live in a dream world, it would be, like, default would be in the office. So Thursday drinks or, like, after work activities. Like, it's not an effort. It's, like, a natural segue. I would give ourselves probably more permission to, like, pause and do these away days or monthly socials and make a bigger deal of those. And I think, because we're all building something mega and we're already busy and already passionate about it, the pausing for lunch thing actually doesn't happen that often. Everyone kind of splinters off. People still have lunch at their desk sometimes. I think that's, and given we're a food brand, I'd like to make that, if I can snap my fingers, that like a sacrosanct moment where we all eat together. But the reality of it is people have loads to do and they want to get it done. So it's interesting. Like, that's, maybe it's something we should change immediately.
I was about to say, is this
a moment where we realise that Manulife needs to pause for an hour every lunch and eat it together?
Is that something that's a blocker because of the people want to just like get deep into the work and focus on the work?
I think there's a passion for the work, and that's at all levels. So it's like me, Johnny, leadership team, rest of the team. There's like a deep drive to push on. Equally, if we did enforce it and say, guys, we're stopping, I'm sure that would happen. But that drive for the work is in everyone. So it's tough.
And I'm assuming you would only stop when you were in person.
It'd be ridiculous. In lockdown, we had like, as lots of people did, we had like wine hours, whatever, and we did chocolate tastings and wine tastings on Zoom, which is kind of, yeah, it's funny to think back to that. But yeah, we definitely wouldn't pause to have Zoom lunch together. I'd hate that. I actually hate Zoom. It's obviously enabled lots of good stuff, but I think it sucks.
I'm a Google Meet kind of guy.
Yeah, love Google Meet.
This love seems to have rippled into lots of different areas of the business. Mm. And you got your first major retail listing with Holland Barrett because somebody from the Leicester Tigers rugby team recommended
completely forgotten about that. Yeah, Greg.
Yeah. How did that happen? Like, why did a Leicester Tiger rugby player recommend you to their sponsor, Holland and Barrett?
I think we just got talking, either on Instagram or like WhatsApp, whatever. He was obviously a fan of the products. And yeah, he'd been either, I can't remember what the guy's name was, but the old CEO, who's a bit of a rugger bugger, had just been in with him. And he was like, look, I'll see what I can do. And this guy obviously waved his magic wand and he was like, you got to go see Stu. And then we went to meet and they listed us. I think he just wanted to help out. Something that I've kind of learned in life is people who like the outside world, whether they probably didn't consider themselves, but people who have made it, inverted commas, tend to get a bit of a kick out of helping others. And it's as selfish as it is selfless. Because it's like makes them feel good. And so giving Greg the opportunity to help Manulife was as great, if not greater, than taking it. But maybe that's rubbish. But yeah, I don't really know why I did it. Maybe just like the product and like me. I'm not sure.
I think it's definitely a combination of the two.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a long time ago. I remember that meeting quite well. It was funny.
What was funny about it?
The guy, Peter Aldis, I think his name was, came in, big burly bloke, was like, yeah, this is Stu. He's mates with Greg. He plays Leicester. Nice to meet you. this is Hannah, who I'm still friendly with. She's a buyer. Like, you guys should chat. And for the first 5 minutes of the meeting, Hannah was so clearly just like, what the hell are we doing here? Like this, like, why? Like, Peter's an idiot. But then as we got talking, you could see her eyes like start to spark, and then she realized actually there's something in this. So yeah, it doesn't always pay to go above the immediate powers to get things done, as it can often spark a negative response. But I think in this case, it didn't eventually.
I suppose when you've got a great product and a great founder, then you can probably win whoever over despite whatever they like preconceptions they have about like you being sneaky and getting in through the powers that be or whatever.
Yeah, maybe. It's like cheekiness often helps.
So then how have you approached building relationships with these people who want to give back? Have you been proactive about it, or has it just been like by chance?
Yeah, it's funny. I kind of, part of me wishes I was much more like strategic and deliberate on the relationships I cultivate. It's often just you meet people, you like them, you become friends over time, and then something falls out of it. Like even with networking, it's just such a horrible name, isn't it? But it's like, I wish I was one of the people, ironically, that could be like, okay, who's going? Who do I need to see? Like, what I want from the evening? But generally I go and just like see what happens. And usually stuff good does happen. And I think maybe if I was one of those people that went into these events like strategic and like, who do I want to meet and who do I want to get stuff out of, then maybe it would lose its magic.
It becomes too transactional.
Yeah. Which, yes, there's transactional and then there's no love and then it's just shit and rubbish.
Yeah. But then again, I suppose, like, I still believe there's a way in which you can be strategic about growing your network with love. So you can think, okay, who do I want to add value to? Who do I want to shower with love? Who I respect and admire?
Yeah.
And then if something happens later on down the line, great, but that was never in my intention.
Yeah, I think the people who are really good in that kind of world are the people that get a kick and make a real concerted effort to do favors. I remember, actually, we were chatting about him earlier, Chris, when I went for a drink with him like years and years ago, he was speaking to me about, and he's very strategic, but he was like, my sales strategy is do one favor a day. And I think on the one hand, it's kind of perverse. It's like, that's a sales strategy. But on the other hand, I think you kind of get addicted to it. And then 4 years later, you've built this amazing network of people who, I guess, may feel like they owe you something. I don't really know.
Who's someone that you admire that you'd love to do a favor for?
AJU. This is going to sound so soppy and naff, but I probably do favors for all the time, but I do feel like my wife Saz has had to put up with a lot whilst we've been building Manulife. And one of the things that I genuinely can't wait for, and we're not far off, like my work is becoming, it'll be intense forever, but it's like less intense than it was. But I genuinely can't wait for the time when it becomes like her time to shine professionally. Like, I think she's probably had to, had to like curb her professional ambitions. We've got two kids, twin girls. My work is for a period was insane. So she was really supportive of me and she's like super ambitious. So yeah, maybe that's a bit of a question dodge, but I'm very excited for that kind of moment.
I don't think it's a question dodge at all, because there's always somebody super supportive behind the scenes of people driving forward a business really intensely.
Yeah.
So did she take a period of not working and looking after the kids, or has she always been working throughout this?
So when we met, I met her trying to sell her a jar of Manulife, early days. She was the breadwinner. And then Manulife grew, that kind of changed slightly. And then when she became pregnant, she kind of freelanced up until very soon before she gave birth. And since then, she's done like bits and bobs. She helps me out a lot spiritually, metaphorically, physically, and administratively with like life in the business. But she hasn't gone back to like full-time professional work since the kids were born. Partly because she thinks to do that would be to, we think, but I think she thinks strongly to do that would be like compromising on the girls. And partly because you'll know this when you have kids, but like childcare is a fucking joke. We worked it out the other day, and then for her to like net zero if they're in full-time childcare, it's like 50 grand a year. So you're at nothing until 50 grand a year, and then you start earning money, which is wild,
isn't it? 50 grand post tax.
I think if you want a nanny, it's 60. But we wouldn't have a nanny; we would just send them to. But then again, that's kind of sacrifice because you'd have to drop them off at nursery in the morning and pick them up at like whatever 4:30. So that's not like full time professional. But yeah, it was 50 grand basic childcare in Manchester, which is cheaper than down here. Before you're anything, that's gross, I think. Which is mental. Like, who on earth can do that?
How do you think it would impact your relationship and family life if she had the freedom to live up to her ambitions?
I think if we both ran businesses and were at the same level of like intensity that I have been historically, it would definitely be really hard. And yeah, we would both have to compromise. It could, I mean, kind of perversely, it could end up being great because there is that thing about like work expanding into the time that you give it. And if we were both having to say we need to be home by 4 p.m., then maybe we just become ruthlessly efficient. Like, yeah, the working mum is like something to behold because they just become like insanely efficient at doing everything because they have to. But yeah, who knows? I basically hope to get to the stage where I can dial it down slightly and she can kind of, the role can kind of flip a bit. And by then the kids will be older, it'll be way easier job for me.
Well, she said some wonderful things about you when I had a chat with her.
That's nice.
I mean, these are sort of values or characteristics with regards to work, but she says that you were instinctive with your decision-making, nimble and reactive.
Yeah. Not sure they're framed as compliments, but yeah.
She said
impulsive is what, yeah.
In a very warm light.
That's nice.
Because it all ties together, this sort of nimble startup mindset, this reactive nature. She said you were super creative and that when you were given gave yourself the role, or you were given the role of new product development, you came up with like six new products in 6 months or something. Yeah. And she was like, yeah, he's incredibly creative and imaginative. Yeah. And then also there are lots of these things that you do which don't scale, like talking to all the customers that have complaints and remembering birthdays, and if someone has a bad day, then you make something for them. Mm. Assuming Manulife is going to keep on its growth trajectory.
Mm. How do you keep that? I think you just have to. And you don't need to do that for everyone. But once you lose, and we did this for a period, we stopped focusing on stuff that didn't scale because we were like, we need to focus on stuff that levers up. You lose a lot of the magic. Like those little personal moments is like, they're not necessarily about like delivering numbers. I think if you do it enough, they do. It's about like fueling the beast. Because if the business becomes right promotions, right space, driving rate of sale in supermarkets, then you become the thing that kept their eye off the ball enough to give you the space to come in. I think this thing about personal touches and doing stuff that doesn't scale is like so important. And it becomes a more challenging problem to integrate as you grow. Like, we're nowhere near that level yet, I don't think. But yeah, it's like super key.
One example, actually,
which we're now starting to roll out in a very non-scalar way. But just after lockdown, I developed this thing called the Peanut Butter Tasting School, which is basically like coffee and wine and beer. They all have tasting schools. They're traditionally craft categories, which is something we're trying to emulate. And peanut butter didn't have one, so we basically made one. And because we couldn't figure out a way to like deliver it to thousands of people, we just stashed it. But 6 or 7 months ago, I could have brought it back out again and started delivering it to people. And it's turned out to be this just insane like trade tool, sales tool. We're going to start running them for consumers. We're not hitting like thousands of people at once, but the 10 people we hit in a group become so like impassioned and love it so much that from what we hear, they tell the friends. Like sometimes it I think it can deliver numbers, but often it's just about like maintaining the energy and the edge, which is as much internal as external. What's your view on that?
I'm very similar to you in that I try and be focused on the individual and pour as much love and attention into it as possible. I love doing these things and they fill up my cup as well. I think that is the intangible, which is not given enough airtime, is that actually, like, you're a sole founder, right? Yeah. And the most amount of pressure is always and will always be on you until you leave the business. Mm-hmm. And people look to you as the leader, much like when I was running Founders and I was running an event, people look to you as the example. Mm-hmm. And if you're there burnt out and like disillusioned and just not into it, then that energy will ripple out.
Which is what happened when we started stopping doing stuff that didn't scale and I burnt out and it was a disaster.
And then that's like you burning out as a founder would just ripple into your team. Yeah. Like there's less energy in the team and that energy then applies to all your customers. So it feels like there are two ways in which you can have impact. You can have thin level across tons of people or very few people and you go deep.
Yeah.
And I think we're similar in that it's less people and going deep.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what's another like personalized deep love or like deep attention moments?
Oh, well, that Manuel has done.
Yeah.
There's a few, but my favorite is actually is way back really early days when it's actually easier to do. But I remember I got a call from a woman who was clearly like a massive fan of Manulife, and she was heavily pregnant. I think she was about to go into labor, and she was like, "Where my delivery of Manulife hasn't come, and I really want it for when I'm in hospital."
Share that like pregnancy craving.
But we ended up Ubering the peanut butter to the hospital to get delivered to her. And then like a few days later, she sent us a picture of her baby like holding the jar. And it was just like that. That was pretty nice. So for a while that led to something that we called, I think like Manny Mums, where if we found out that our consumers were pregnant or like heavily pregnant, we would send them like a pregnancy care pack. That is something that actually, though, that you could scale. And I think one of the things that was missing, which is less missing now, is like the mindset to be like, okay, this is a really cool thing that we've come up with in like a magical moment. How do we translate this thing into like a machine that happens, that can happen with a bit less effort? Because often how it played out was someone on the team, often me, but not always, would like spot something and be like, guys, everyone stop. We got to do this. And yeah, it was pretty quite disruptive, but then it would fill up everyone's cup and you'd move on. But if you had a kind of a machine, an engineer mind, which we've got a few more of them now, then all of a sudden that just builds into the pulse. And every mum who eats Manulife gets a pregnancy pack on the way to hospital. I've got so many ideas here, AJ. Jesus.
And this ties into community building as well, right? Yeah. Like community building at the start is very personal. It's all of you, all you. And then as you systematize things, then the sort of energy spreads and other people start producing that energy for other people in the community.
Which is what you know loads about. I've got lots to learn on that. But
some things that would be very difficult, like you having a call with everyone who complains.
Yeah.
When there's any one individual, which is usually the founder, because like that's why founder-led sales is so impactful. Yeah. And the founder calling you up if you ever complain, but like, hey, I'm Stu from Manulife. Yeah. Like I started it 8 years ago. You said you had an issue with that, with a jar that arrived. Like, what can I do? Like that makes a huge impact on a customer who's had a complaint. And as you say, like one of the biggest opportunities comes from people who complain. Mm. And you can, when you flip them around, they become huge advocates.
Yeah.
How would you remove yourself from that to systematize something like that?
It's tricky, isn't it? Because it's like, there is something about being called up by the founder. And like one of the things you could say, and we did actually say this in the early days, was like, everyone's the founder. Whoever you speak to, you're the founder. And so like salespeople would be like, they'd go into shops and be like, yeah, so I founded this business. Freddie's Flowers actually did the same with their door-to-door salespeople. So you could do that, but that feels a bit disingenuous. I think it's just hiring people and putting people in those roles that like really care, who are personable and value interaction, like can read the room. And take complaints seriously. I think you probably get to the stage where you're selling, I don't know, tens of millions of jars a month. And even if your complaint percentage is like 0.001%, like that degree of care becomes quite tricky. But yeah, it's just like good customer service. You know, there are some businesses that are awesome at it, like Virgin or that American Express. And there are some that are terrible, like Ryanair and
Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Amazon is amazing because, and it's funny, when you meet former Amazon employees, there's a certain archetype. And it's like the Amazon brand isn't a brand in the conventional sense of like emotive response, like loyalty. The Amazon brand is a function. And it's funny because they do such a good job. It's almost that's their moat. But like if someone came along that and did 75% as good a job as Amazon, I think they'd be buggered. But their strength is they're just so far ahead of everyone. I feel icky. In fact, I need to be careful saying this because we sell quite a lot of stuff through them. But one doesn't necessarily always feel great buying stuff through Amazon. They'd often much rather buy stuff through their local bookshop, whatever. But they are just so good that you're kind of locked in. It's one of the reasons why I think they've maybe never fully managed to unlock food. There's maybe more emotion wrapped up in the consumption and purchasing of food. And Amazon is just like pure function.
And then it feels like you're on the other end with like pure...
completely dysfunctional. Yeah.
More like pure like human centrism.
Yeah, that's the aim. I mean, obviously we don't always manage that. And I definitely don't always manage that. But the idea is like every interaction with Manny Life is like beautiful. And complaints, as you flagged earlier, I would say are like an amazing opportunity to have a proper conversation with a consumer. Because how often do consumers just call you up to talk about how happy they are?
So then going back to building that team that cares.
Yeah.
How do you build a hiring process around measuring for care?
We did put this one thing in, which it's called the waiter test. And I've done it more or less with everyone I've ever hired. And it's basically Manny Life hiring process. We do like skills, attitude. We've got like value questions we ask. But part of every process is I'll take the candidate to a restaurant or a cafe, somewhere where there's a waiter. And you just look at how they treat the waiter. And it's like, if you don't treat the waiter well, you're out. And if you treat them amazingly well, that's like points. If you're polite, that's kind of nothing. But there have been a few people who were like amazing candidates. And then we took them to a cafe and they were rude to the waiter. And I was like, we can't hire this person. Because it's a sad fact and it shouldn't be the case. But there is a thing in the UK where like the waiting profession is seen as like a stepping stone and there's a bit of a status thing. And it's like they're your server. And I just feel that people that aren't good to people who are, it sounds just gross even saying it, but like in a position of like a lower position than you, I think it's just is a really horrible thing. That's how I get a sense of what they're like as people.
I like absolutely adore that. Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah. And it's spoken about by so many people that it is actually such a good litmus test for just someone at their core, especially in a point where maybe their guard is down.
Yeah, exactly.
And so then the true colours shine. Are there any other aspects? I know you said you're not very process-driven, but I'm assuming like when you craft the job description or maybe you craft interview questions, do you keep this idea of care and love in mind?
Yeah, no, I do. I do definitely. Another one is how people... the degree to which they referred to I versus we and appreciation for others. Because it's very rare that people achieve anything on their own. And so generally people who acknowledge that and refer to we tend to sway that way. Whereas those that talk about I did this, I did that, usually sway the other way. That's actually quite a big one.
And so then as the sole founder and the person coming on the podcast and the face of Manny Life, how do you then try and ripple the love and attention that you get into the team and shift the focus away from you into us?
Probably not very well on reflection. I guess it's like shouting people out when they do good stuff, which is often, and probably do it enough, but try and make a concerted effort to do that. Sharing feedback that comes through me with the team. I like to think I show appreciation and thanks lots. Probably could do it more. Just like saying thank you and well done. When it's due, it's bad to fake it, but when it's due, I think makes quite a big difference. I'm talking like I'm a master of this. I definitely could be way better and could show a lot more love. But there is always that balance of like the stress of we need to keep going, we need to keep driving, which probably plays out slightly differently. But you just need to constantly remind yourself that making everyone around you feel good and happy is pretty important. Conversely, that's almost more straightforward when going back to the early days when everyone was volunteers, because it's like that's obviously the only way you do it. Whereas when you start building a team and you professionalize a bit, it's like how do you balance the need to be really firm and hold people accountable and like high standards with the desire to keep everyone happy and keep them loving work and keep them loving the kind of environment you're creating. And that I think creates, and definitely at some points did create kind of conflict, internal conflict rather than conflict within the business.
What did you learn from that conflict?
So one of the habits that got built up in that initial period of volunteers was like, these guys are doing this ultimately like for me, they're enjoying it, for nothing. So anything I ask them to do, I need to do a bit of myself. Otherwise, it's like completely outrageous. So when it flipped into professionalized team world, that translated into like a habitual thing, which was like when stuff wasn't being done fast enough or like done the way that I mean, wanted to do, I would just go and do it myself, which is like management 101, a terrible thing to do. But that was from the period when it was like, I can't ask these guys to do things that I wouldn't do myself. So there is that thing of like people actually way prefer to be held accountable and left to get on with their job and actually hate having you jump in, which is kind of obvious and cliched. Then one of the other things is just like clarity and clarity of communication and calmness, and the over communication is like incredibly valuable, particularly as the team grows. Early days, I find it quite awkward to like hold people to account, which is quite a funny thing, but people obviously love being able to held to account. But if you're just clear, being like, this is what I expect from you, go out and do it. Like that's not, most people actually don't have an issue with that. But for me, because I had this thing of like, I can't ask people to do things because I'm not paying them for a long period. I feel that like ingrained in my psyche to a degree that definitely wasn't helpful, which probably wasn't why I wasn't a very good manager for a period. Maybe still aren't.
Feels like this battle is between like the long game and the short game.
Mm.
The short game is like, got to hit these targets. We've got to go, 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 holding people to account.
Mm.
We've got to like make sure the ship is going at the right speed in the right direction.
Mm.
And the long term is like, we've got to keep the magic alive.
Mm.
We've got to invest in our team, like their development. And it feels like there's this constant battle, like quarterly results versus we're building a 10-year or 100-year-old company.
Yeah.
Do any other things feel like they fall obviously into one or either of those buckets?
So if we look at innovation, there's multiple strands, but some of it fits in short. So things like collaboration. So like, yeah, this is a great example. So we did a beer with Brixton Brewery. Cool beer, great time. Did a massive event, got loads of eyeballs. That is like a short-term hit that unlikely to be around in years to come. But then you have innovation like the like deep roast peanut butter or like new formats or the release of our organic, which was like this massive project. And those are things that will like direct the business and direct peanut butter in a different direction forever. Like deep roast has changed peanut butter forever, which is quite cool. So innovation is one. If you have the patience and like the kind of bravery to ignore the short-term flicks and focus on the long-term in like building the machine and like setting it up properly, then I think invariably you do better. The personal touches piece is is potentially quite an interesting one, because on an individual basis, they're very short term. But if you add them all up, they become this like long term community.
And the love compounds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like the love flywheel. Yeah, we flywheel our love in my life. See, there's probably a bit of crossover. And I think you've got to have a bit of both. And I definitely bring the frantic's maybe not the right word, but like urgency. And Johnny's probably, fair to say, much better at the like calm, let's think out 3 months ahead, 6 months, 12 months. And we'll often like force the discussion and thought processes into that. But my tendency, my sweet spot is like here and now, which is probably why I did sort of the start, because that's like when you're getting going, that's what you need. It's important to give yourself the time to think long term. And that was, we were always able to do that. I think more importantly, though, it's important to have the mix of like urgency and high energy with like calm stability. Because if you live in like urgent world for extended periods, you just get fried. And I think the new blend of team that we have is a much more like marathon, not sprint version, if you see what I mean. Because ultimately, like, it's a sprint at the start because you're racing to get to a stage where you can like survive without worrying about running out of money every day. But we're building a company that's going to be around for, as you say, like tens, hundreds of years. And that's not a sprint. So you have to marry the two.
But within that 100-year journey, you still have to have sprints.
Yeah, which is...
It's sprint and rest and sprint and rest and sprint and rest, as opposed to like one slow, long jog for 26 miles, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's quite funny. A good metaphor for this is... Mine versus Saz's Strava when we go for runs. So my wife Saz is a really good runner. And when Saz goes for a run on her Strava, it's just like up, flat line for forever, like same pace and then down. She's great, like ultramarathon runner. My Strava is like literally watching a dog that like finds things and then drops them and then finds another thing and then drops it. And it's just like, it's like a heart monitor with no rhythm. But that's kind of my characters. Love little sprints.
And then you've done an amazing job of hiring Johnny, who is more like Saz in company terms.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So a good team. It's great. And the team is a great blend of those. I mean, there's obviously multiple types of personalities, but that on that vector is quite a good blend.
You've spoken before about getting out of the way of your team.
Yeah.
How have you done that well?
It's funny, I actually think I have done quite a good job of that recently, because for a period I probably didn't do that good a job of it. The big thing is like hiring the right people. And obviously you've spoken about Johnny, but there are loads of other people in the team that play into that. And then it's, agreeing the kind of the big goals for the business, the vision for the business, having the trust that they'll come to me when appropriate. And also having the trust that they don't, they've got it covered. And then, just like lead them to it. Whilst at the same time, staying involved. it's quite a hard question to ask. I guess, it's just, you just agree the goals, lead them to it and catch up every so often. I'm still like very much in the business, but I'm in the business, Johnny's managing it. And I'm in the business working on like individual projects or things that I have kind of picked up. And I'm now, whereas for a period, when I was running things, as it grew, we spoke about this earlier, but as it grew, like great team in place, but my head was still in everything they were doing. And so I couldn't really do anything. And because I was completely fried. Whereas now, when I'm having, say, one-to-ones with Johnny or one-to-ones with a few of the other guys, it's like my head will be in what they're doing then and a bit before. But once those conversations are over, it's like they got it and it's back in the stuff that I need to do. Sounds like it pretty straightforward.
It sounds like something that requires a certain level of practice.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Just a muscle that you build up over time.
Didn't really do much before Manulife. So it's got came eventually.
Getting into the end. So What do you think is unique about you as a CEO?
Tough question. And I'll try and keep it on the positives.
Or balance it.
So I immediately jump to like passion, but passion isn't a unique thing about, I'd say most probably are. I think I definitely have, if not unique, like high end of the bell curve, find a way to get it done mentality. And that's played out like throughout life, not just business life. I genuinely believe, probably to some extent, quite annoyingly at times, like there is always a way, you just need to find it. So whatever you call that, like resourcefulness or whatever, I would say that's probably the one. There might be some others, but I'll WhatsApp them to you and we can do a voice note.
Amazing. Last question. I haven't tried this before, so I'm going I'm experimenting. Okay, I want to try and have the effect of this conversation last longer than us being here.
Okay, that's nice.
And specifically for you.
Okay, oh, cool.
So if, assume the whole world is listening, which, fingers crossed.
Yeah, one day.
One day. If you were to ask a favor, given that like that's been an amazing part of Man in Life and like the love, if you were to ask a favor of anyone in the world at the moment, what could people support you with?
Oh, wow. So, I mean, the obvious answer is find Man in Life, try it. I don't know. That is one, like, no joking aside, try it, because genuinely it's unbelievable. I think it does actually make people pretty happy having it, which is wild. And then give it to a friend.
What about you personally?
Okay, my mind's immediately jumping to like call your gran, but that's not for me. That's because I've got this thing about that came out of lockdown where just I was really close to my gran, I think people don't speak to their grandparents enough, and like the idea of like grands and grandpas at home alone is quite shit. But that's not for me.
She's still with us.
No, she's not. She died sadly 6 months ago.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, no, she's old there.
Here's a deep one. Yeah. If people were to pray to your gran collectively, what would you want them to say?
Well done. Like, she was awesome. She got diagnosed with MS, like, quite young. I don't think it was MS, but it was quite debilitating. So in like early 30s. And she just had this, like, insane ability to be in the moment and deal and, like, find joy in basic things and, like, be really caring, be really funny. And, yeah, it was very... She didn't really know... I don't think she really appreciated it, but she had, like, an insane amount of... wasn't grit, because grit is like grit imbibes like tenacity. It was more, it was just resilience. And she was very calming. Like whenever I had crazy stressful times at my life, I went up to see her and it was just like an immediate relax. So yeah, well done would be what I'd say to her. Favor for me.
Assume every founder in Europe
is
listening to this right now.
So this is super technical.
Amazing.
We are like a brand that was initially built on community. We have a natural affinity for community, and we have like the highest net promoter score in peanut butter, which means that people refer us to more of their friends than any other brand, which should lead, like strategically, into us having a really strong D2C and D2C channel, because that's like facilitator of community, like. You manage all the touch points. But our DC channel, because we've never had someone in it who's had the skill set, and because it's never quite kicked off, it's always been a bit of an afterthought. I really want to change that, because the channel has never made lots of money. We've never like invested properly in it. And I think we're stuck in this like poverty loop on DC. And I think it could be like fucking enormous, but no one in the team is an expert. To bring an expert in is expensive, and like the payback takes a while, and like no, and because I can't make all the decisions anymore, like we're not making the bet. And I think that channel has like so much potential. One, because it's just, it's, you're in control, but also if we want to build out this community, that getting that channel right is like a means to make the work put into the community pay for itself. So it's like the favor would be someone who's really good at that come and help us do it for an initial low fee, and the knowledge that when you do a great job, we'll be able to pay you loads.
Yeah. That's very strong. That's a perfect sort of ask. And I'm so sad to say that we're out of time, but this has been unreal.
Yeah,
and
good.
I honestly think that you're a very unique CEO with the level of passion and enthusiasm and love, like love and care are the thing that really shines through.
That's so nice. Thanks, AJ.
And like you can tell, even with like your Instagram, like I've been eating Man Alive for a while and just all these small touches do come through in lots of different ways. I know someone who's worked at one of your competitors and they said that Man Alive is, they think, the best peanut butter. And I think that's not just a matter of taste. Yeah. I think that is a large part due to the love and care that you've instilled in the team and the people you've attracted around. And that has then led to just the brand and the ethos around Man Alive. So I think that's awesome.
AJ, that's so nice. I think I might cry, but thank you. Appreciate that. I love this as well. You're a very good interviewer.